want the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from me here at peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear an explosive interview with Trevor Aronson, a reporter at Al Jazeera America, and his senior producer from the investigative team, Jeremy Young. They've just released an important hour-long documentary called FBI Informants, and they profile three men, all with criminal backgrounds, who were paid pretty large sums of money by the FBI to infiltrate Muslim communities. And they are at the center of three prosecutions of individuals accused of domestic terrorism that I consider to be complete concoctions, frame-ups. We'll get to that in just a moment, but first I'd like to thank the people who support my work here with their subscriptions. People like Deborah Kennedy, Craig Balog, Judy Holloway, and Steve Wozenski. I'd like you to join their ranks so I can keep bringing you this independent, investigative, and conversation work. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture, there's a link that says sign up. When you click on it, it takes you to a page where you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. Our best deal is the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers in the U.S. get a copy of John Dist's really cool CD called Red Flag. And while it lasts, a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans, supplied by our friend Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. Trevor Aronson, the author of Terror Factory, returns to our program today. And he is now working at Al Jazeera America, where he recently was the front anchor for a powerful documentary called FBI Informants. In the show file for this podcast, we'll put the link up so that you can go to Al Jazeera America's website and watch this powerful one-hour documentary. It's 47 minutes when you take out the commercials. It's an excellent production that profiles three individuals who served as FBI informants targeting Muslim groups and Muslim communities in this country. Trevor is the author, as I mentioned, of Terror Factory, and I take it you were one of the first hires at Al Jazeera a little over a year ago, is that right?
Yeah, about a year ago during the launch of Al Jazeera America, the network launched what became known as Al Jazeera's investigative unit, and I was hired around that time. Yeah, so we're about 16 people, and we have offices in Washington, London, and Doha.
Mm-hmm. All right. And also with you at whatever location you're at today, there's Jeremy Young, the senior producer for this documentary. And I take it you're on the documentary team, too. Is that right?
I'm on the investigative team, too, for Al Jazeera's investigative unit, but I've worked here a little longer than Trevor. I've been here since 2006.
Okay. Very interesting. And because I know a little bit more about Trevor, tell our listeners about your background, particularly in investigating the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Jeremy.
Yeah, so my background for Al Jazeera, I've reported and produced all over the world for the network in places like Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, and more recently, since I became the senior investigative producer here in Washington, I got credentialed at the Department of Justice, and I do a lot of national security work here in Washington for the channel.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I really have seen a lot of good enterprise journalism at Al Jazeera America, and I'm pleased to see it because, Trevor, you know, you published an important book where you profiled and really went deep on more than 500 cases of domestic terrorism in this country. And you came up with roughly a 1% figure of those that didn't involve a paid informant, an agent provocateur, the FBI providing the means and methods for an individual to carry out some plot that was being concocted. And I just want to ask, did you shop your work to ABC, CBS, NBC, and, that CNN thing?
No. You know, it never occurred to me initially to make a documentary building on the work in the book. And it was actually an idea that originated here after I had taken a job at Al Jazeera. And Jeremy and I got teamed up to work on this project where our goal was to build off of the book, but also be able to uncover a lot of new material. So, I mean, our mandate is to find things out that are new, obviously, being an investigative unit. And, you know, what we felt very strongly about was that this was a story that had a lot of tentacles and there were new areas that we could explore. And we cast our net pretty wide in the beginning. And then we realized that, you know, to tell a powerful story, to tell a story of 15,000 informants and hundreds of counterterrorism sting operations, if we told three of them really close to the bone, we told the story of three informants very close to the bone, that could be representative of the larger trend and allow people to see, you know, how problematic some of these sting operations are. And perhaps most importantly, to show that the informants that the FBI uses are often problematic themselves. You know, these are criminals and con men who are literally on the front line of the FBI's war on terrorism.
Mm-hmm. My point in raising that, though, is that I haven't seen this level of investigative reporting, even on the vaunted 60 Minutes show, on your competitor networks. I don't see them delving into these touchy issues of FBI overreach and the framing of people in these domestic terrorism cases.
Yeah, well, I would say the one thing about Al Jazeera that tends to be different is that they're not afraid to do more provocative journalism. They're not afraid to ask different types of questions. I think they've really set themselves apart from the rest of the pack in their approach to storytelling and their approach to investigative journalism as well. So we're really happy to have this opportunity to do this type of in-depth investigative reporting and to be able to air a one-hour film on the network as a result is really a tremendous opportunity that I think, you know, people will notice a difference with Al Jazeera than they will with hour-long programs that are on other cable news networks.
And Jeremy, Trevor, with your indulgence, I'd like to kind of flip the order of things and for our listeners, play the very end segment, the audio track from the documentary, because I think that you reached a powerful conclusion that is a good place for us to start our discussion today. Let's listen. And let me set this up, that this last scene is you go up and knock on the door of a guy in it's Toledo, Ohio, right? Who has been outed by people in the Muslim community as a likely government informant. And your efforts to interview him have produced no response from him. So you go to his house and in, you know, investigative journalism ambush style, you go up and knock on the door.
Hi, Mohammed Rashid.
Yeah.
I'm a reporter with Al Jazeera. My name is Trevor Aronson.
What's up?
And we're doing a story about informants in Muslim communities for the FBI. And we're hoping to interview you about your work as an FBI informant.
No kidding.
How long have you been working for the FBI?
I'm sorry. I can't tell you.
A lot of informants are coerced to work with the FBI. I mean, can you say whether you were coerced in any way, or did you volunteer?
I can't give you any comments about this as we speak right now. I can't confirm, I can't deny, I'm not telling you anything about the FBI.
Right, okay.
The FBI has more than 15,000 informants, many of them spying on U.S. Muslim communities. Like the closer, the bodybuilder, and the trainer, these spies lurk in the dark corners of America's justice system. Neighbor informing on neighbor, one American luring another, a nation spying on itself on orders from the FBI.
And Trevor, I think that's a very powerful summation of your investigative documentary. And you were the first, in at least in my knowledge, to identify that number of 15,000 paid informants. Is that a current number, or has it actually increased since you originally published Terror Factory?
Yeah, it gets bandied around a lot now. I think I was one of the first to make it a public figure. Unfortunately, this isn't a number that the FBI gives out, you know, publicly. That, you know, they you can't ask them and have them give it to you. You can't file a records request and have it give it to you. So we only really have historical markers when the FBI has been compelled to give those numbers. And the most recent was in 2006 when they requested several million dollars to launch a computer program or start a computer program that would allow them to track the many informants that the FBI had. And at that time, the FBI admitted that it had 15,000. You know, most agents that you talk to today will say the number ranges from 14,000 to 15,000. I'm sorry, excuse me, 14,000 to 16,000. But I feel confident in saying, you know, there's more than 15,000, but we just don't have a more exact number available right now.
And is there an actual published budget of the money that they pay to these informants and provocateurs?
No, and that isn't something like the overall number. You cannot get through a FOIA request or by asking your friendly local FBI agent. The truth is that we only know what we know because the FBI has been forced to disclose it. And what we do know in some of these FBI sting operations is that informants can make, you know, a lot of money. One of the informants that we profiled in the documentary, Darren Griffin, who worked in Toledo, Ohio, was paid $350,000 for his work on a case. Shahed Hussein, who's a very prolific informant, who worked in Albany, worked on the Newburgh 4 case outside New York City, and has also worked in Pittsburgh, as well as other cities that probably have not been disclosed. You know, in the Newburgh 4 case, for example, he made $100,000 with a performance incentive after conviction that's never been disclosed. And, you know, based on the fact that many of these informants move from case to case and get paid handsome sums each way, you know, it stands to reason that the good ones are making a lot of money for the FBI.
And you mentioned the Newburgh 4, which is the subject of a documentary that's now running on HBO. And I thought they did a pretty good job of exposing the issues there as well. Trevor, let's give people a quick thumbnail of the three FBI informants who you profile in this documentary, starting with Eli Assad, who is tagged as the closer. And this was, I believe, one of the first cases that you investigated when you were living in Florida, the case of the Liberty City 7. Is that correct?
Yeah. I'll introduce your listeners to Eli, and then I think Jeremy would be best to describe Craig and Darren Griffin.
Right.
You know, Eli and I have kind of personal history because, you know, back in 2006, I was working as a reporter in Miami and heard about the Liberty City 7 case. And this was a case of seven men who had no connections to Al-Qaeda, had no weapons, and really had very limited economic resources. They were in one of the poorest sections of Miami. And Eli Assad, who calls himself the closer, prides himself on the fact that he will go in and make good a case that a government informant or an undercover agent had not been able to move forward. And he's the one that went in and was able to get the Liberty City 7 to pledge an oath to Al-Qaeda in this very cartoonish fashion, and prosecutors would use that at trial to show that these men were committed to getting involved in a conspiracy to support Al-Qaeda. At the same time, though, as we show in our documentary, Eli Assad moved over to El Paso, was convicted of beating his wife, led police in El Paso on a high-speed chase, was convicted of DUI, and in general was committing crimes while he was working as a government informant. And what's unique about, or what's not unique about that, is the fact that many informants are criminals. And Jeremy, I think, is going to be best to describe Craig for us.
All right, yeah. And let me, just before you do that, let me note the high-profile case of the mafia don Whitey Bulger, whose defense claims were largely ignored at trial. But I think he raised pretty substantial issues that he was a paid FBI operative at the same time that he was running a crime syndicate and continuing to commit murders. And so the history of the FBI enlisting deeply unsavory characters is a pretty long-running one, wouldn't you say, Trevor?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, FBI agents would tell you that, you know, choir boys can't find criminals, and that's true. But at the same time, I think the FBI has had questionable control mechanisms and have allowed their informants to commit crimes while they're working for the FBI or other agencies. You know, the ATF has a similarly bad record of informants committing crimes while working for the government. And I think that raises a lot of problems. You know, in addition, the most significant one is that the FBI and federal law enforcement are relying to such a heavy degree on people who are professional liars, who are criminals themselves and have an economic incentive to find other criminals. And that creates an environment where you have the potential to either target people who you shouldn't or in some cases even manufacture crimes.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy, go ahead and tell us about Craig Monte, the bodybuilder.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things, too, I'll just mention real quick about a difference between these counterterrorism cases and some of the organized crime cases is, yes, you need to have somebody who is comfortable around criminals to be able to infiltrate an organization like the mafia. But to send a criminal into a mosque where the overwhelming majority of the people are not committing crimes creates a very different contrast. And so for Craig, for example, his nickname was the bodybuilder because, well, he's huge. And, you know, his sort of ruse was that he was to work as a personal trainer and that he would approach people who were overweight in the mosque and he would offer to help them lose weight and help design a workout regimen. And his idea was that he would get people out of the mosque and into the gym where they would tire themselves out and they would be vulnerable to his ploys. And, you know, that's how he got the nickname the bodybuilder, and his entire operation was known as Operation Flex. And the third individual who we look at in the film, Darren Griffin, a lot less is known about Darren, which is the reason why we found his story so interesting. His nickname was the trainer. He was a former special ops soldier in the U.S. Army, served in Iraq. And he went into a mosque in Toledo, Ohio to convert to Islam, and he told people that he felt bad about his role in the war in Iraq, and he wanted to make up for those misdeeds, and that's why he was joining Islam. And I think that just shows you sort of the, you know, depths at which the FBI is willing to sink in order to carry out some of these sting operations.
And coming back to Craig Monte in Southern California, I think it was very interesting because you spent some time with members of the Muslim community there, including a man named Ilush, who is the leader of CARE, the pro-Arab organization in Los Angeles. And he really describes feeling betrayed because he had tried to build bridges between the FBI and his Muslim community. And talk about the role of FBI Deputy Director Tidwell, who came to an outreach meeting with members of the Muslim community. And it was a very testy exchange where they basically said he was misleading them. And then he blustered back, "Are you calling me a liar?"
Yeah, and, you know, we were really excited when we found that video and were able to insert it into the piece because we think it gives viewers a sense of sort of the feelings that individuals in the Muslim community had about the spying that was going on. And what happened essentially was that a local reporter had gotten a soundbite from an FBI agent who was talking about carrying out surveillance on student groups. And so, you know, the assistant director, Tidwell, at the meeting, you know, came out and said, well, you know, we are not spying on groups. And people in the community said, well, someone's lying. Either you're lying to us or someone lied to a reporter about the programs that you have going on. And they were trying to get the FBI to, to explain who was right and who was wrong, and that they never sort of had a satisfactory resolution to that at that point.
Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting because there is an imam named Fazaga, and he is one of the people who was willing to confront Tidwell, and he also was very suspicious of Monte, who was busy, you know, trying to infiltrate that Muslim mosque.
Yeah, Peter, what's interesting about what happened to Imam Yasser Fazaga is that he alleges, and Craig Monte, the informant, also alleges that the reason he was targeted by the FBI for surveillance had nothing to do with any suspicion that he was involved in terrorism, but had everything to do with the fact that he stood up and challenged the FBI and exercised his First Amendment right in that town hall meeting. You know, of course, the FBI declined our repeated request to participate in our documentary. Stephen Tidwell also declined an invitation to be interviewed, so we couldn't get them to respond to that allegation. But what we do know is that the Yasser Fazaga, working with the Council on American Islamic Relations and the ACLU, filed a lawsuit, class action lawsuit, against the FBI, alleging his violations were violated as a result of this operation, and the Justice Department was able to quash the lawsuit by declaring the powerful state secrets privilege, which basically said this lawsuit isn't going to go anywhere because we fear it's going to put national security at risk. So it's you know, maybe 30, 40 years from now, when these records become available under FOIA, we'll have an exact answer. But it does appear that the FBI targeted Fazaga for the fact that he challenged them. And no evidence has ever been provided to suggest that Yasser Fazaga was involved in any kind of terrorist activity. And I think certainly anyone who has ever met Yasser Fazaga would find that very hard to believe.
And Trevor, of the three men that you profile, Craig Monte is the only one who left the FBI and essentially turned on his former handlers and paymasters.
Right. You know, Craig Monte's cover was blown as a result of some bad handling at the FBI. You know, Craig was told to go into the Orange County Muslim community and, you know, incite them and talk about committing violence. And he was so over the top that the Orange County Muslim community turned him into the FBI. And that essentially blew his cover when the FBI didn't handle that very well. And that, mixed with a general frustration of how the FBI handled him, caused Craig to, you know, switch sides. And he's been very public about what the FBI asked him to do. And his feeling is that the FBI isn't finding real terrorists in connection to operations like his, and that this really is a blanket surveillance of the Muslim community without any predicate, without any reason to believe that the particular targets of this surveillance are connected to any sort of violent plot.
And Trevor, when you look at this case, which is pretty amazing in many respects, and you know a fair amount, perhaps even things that you have decided not to publish or broadcast, but can you even stretch the facts of this case to create a state secrets situation where the government, not because of embarrassment, but because of actual, you know, national security cases, needs to keep these operative methods secret? Or is this simply another convenient way for the government to cover up its own abusive behavior?
Yeah, Peter, I mean, that's a great question. And the truth is, it would require some speculation on my part. What we can say, you know, in the realm of fact, is that no successful prosecutions resulted from Craig's activity. Craig never left the country. And so the question of whether this would have ever involved foreign actors who were involved in some sort of terrorism plot in the United States that would require the state secrets privilege to protect undercover agents, to protect methodologies, you know, we've never seen any facts to suggest that. What we do know is that one prosecution came out of Craig's case. A man named Ahmed Niazi was charged with lying on his naturalization paperwork. And Ahmed Niazi was his brother-in-law in Afghanistan had a connection to Osama bin Laden, or the FBI believed. From what we understand, they tried to recruit Ahmed Niazi, and this is what Ahmed Niazi claimed, to become an informant, and then when he refused, they brought this charge against him. And Ahmed Niazi's charges were dropped. There has been no connection that's ever been publicly brought forward that connects Ahmed Niazi to any terrorist group. And so for that reason, you know, I don't have a good answer of whether the FBI really, the Department of Justice really was protecting national secrets, or whether this was a convenient mechanism for them not to account for the fact that they were caught spying on Muslim communities without a specific predicate. I leave that up to the viewer, given the circumstances, the view of our documentary, to decide. There hasn't been any facts provided yet that would suggest there was a reason to protect national security. I think a cynical viewer may think this was an easy way for the FBI to not have to answer questions.
And before we started recording, Trevor and Jeremy, I mentioned that my own history goes back to COINTELPRO when J. Edgar Hoover was running the FBI and Richard Nixon was the president. And I ended up being a subject of COINTELPRO, and I got the documents later under the Freedom of Information Act. And when I did that, I also collected a lot of other documents that had been published as a result of the congressional investigations in the 1970s, particularly in the case of the FBI, the Pike Commission. And one of the things that was notable is that on all of the memos authorizing covert operations and these counterintelligence activities, J. Edgar Hoover's initials would appear on the top of the memo. And I'm curious if in the current era, if you have found anything that directly links the former director, Robert Mueller, or the current director, James Comey, to the approval of the expenditures, of the means and methods, of the recruitment of, what do we have here, a convicted wife beater, a convicted con artist, and I'm just curious if you've been able to find anything that goes directly to the director's office.
You know, Craig, Peter, to some extent, you know, a director like Comey or Mueller before him has a very much a 10,000-foot view. So they're removed somewhat in the exact activities of these operations. That said, what we do know is that the FBI has a committee of high-level officials reporting directly to Mueller, or now Comey, who have to approve what are called highly sensitive operations. And that would involve the targeting or investigation of a journalist, for example, or a politician. Or, you know, among the people covered by that would be a religious leader, such as Imam Yasser Fasiga. So the circumstances are such to believe that these operations would have required high-level approval, and the director of the FBI would have been briefed on them. Whether it actually needs the director's signature to authorize that is not something that's clear to me. That might be something that we'll find out years from now when this becomes available under FOIA. However, I think it's also worth noting that when Robert Mueller and most recently Comey went before Congress to talk about the great work that the FBI is doing, that the directors frequently cite these types of undercover sting operations as successes of the FBI. You know, you mentioned the Newberg case earlier. The Newberg case was one that Robert Mueller enjoyed telling Congress how they stopped an attack that would have targeted synagogues in the Bronx. Of course, what he doesn't tell Congress is that the only reason that attack would have occurred in the first place was that it was orchestrated by the FBI and the bombs were provided by the FBI. So obviously the director of the FBI is aware of these operations. How much the director is aware that these operations involve criminals, like in the Newberg case, a man who fled Pakistan on murder charges, or in a case in Seattle, a convicted child molester and rapist. You know, I don't know exactly whether they'd have that level of detail, but these operations are so frequent, and counterterrorism is the largest part of the FBI's budget. I think only an incompetent director wouldn't have some knowledge of what's happening with these operations.
Well, and I would think just in the bureaucratic zone that the approval of six-figure amounts for payments to the provocateurs and informants and for the walking around money. I mean, in each of these cases, the FBI informants were willing to buy all kinds of things for these generally impoverished dweebs that they were working over.
Yeah, and you'll find that as a pattern in a lot of these cases is that a significant amount of money was involved. And, you know, whether in some cases it was $50,000, in some cases it was as much as $250,000, you know, the individuals who are often penniless need that money. And the government says, well, we offered that money as a means to finance an attack. I don't think that the individual who receives the money really cares why they're being, under what circumstances they're receiving the money. They just want to have the cash.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I'm very curious about, because of the parallels, you described former Director Mueller bragging about the Newberg case as a way to show Congress how effective all this has been. Similar representations have been made by NSA officials and James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence. But when they're pressed, the only case they could come up with was a small group of guys in San Diego who raised $7,500 and sent it to Al-Shabaab. And we're supposed to believe that the interception of our phone calls, the collection of the metadata, and all of the other unconstitutional domestic surveillance efforts that are underway protected us from dangerous terrorist plots. But the government really is hard-pressed to come up with significant examples. Are you able to find any interaction between NSA surveillance and these targeted domestic terrorism cases? Trevor?
Yeah, Peter, I mean, that's a question that I think will be answered, you know, in the coming months or years. I think there are a number of questionable cases where the targets of investigations have been identified through means that seem very unlikely. You know, for example, a case in Tampa, a man named Sammy Osmakosh. He was targeted by an FBI sting operation and led with an undercover agent to bomb a nightclub in Tampa. And according to the FBI affidavit, they identified him as a suspect because he walked into a store that just so happened to be owned by an FBI informant and asked to buy Al-Qaeda flags. I remember when I first looked at that case, it was pretty incredible to me that the coincidence would be so great that this apparent extremist would happen to walk into an FBI informant's store and be so stupid as to ask for Al-Qaeda flags, but that was the FBI's claim. What's interesting about that case, and this is true of several other cases, such as Mohammed in Portland, is that after the Snowden revelations, the FBI has been forced to reveal that it has used FISA-obtained information and did not disclose that to the court at the time. And so I think that does raise questions of whether through the blanket surveillance that the government is doing, some of these sting operation targets are identified through this potentially illegal surveillance that the NSA is doing. You know, that hasn't been proven, but I think there's, you know, what I've just stated is a facts of these cases, and that certainly raises questions. I also think, you know, any law enforcement organization, it's hard to believe that they would have a pool of data that they could mine and they could find a way to keep their hands off it. I mean, I think that's just human nature that they'd want to look into it.
Well, and in the same vein, Trevor, we have the recently exposed Stingray program, which is where they insert a fake cell phone tower in a certain geographical area, and they're able to capture all of the cell phone data that is passing through there. And we've seen revelations that in Florida, Stingray has been used in a number of prosecutions, but has never been revealed to the court or to the defendants, which is a clear constitutional violation. And they say that they can't reveal it because they signed a non-disclosure agreement with the company that makes the Stingray system. I mean, that's even less credible than the assertion of state secrets.
Right, absolutely. I think I've been following that case in Florida, and there are a lot of really concerning aspects to it. You know, like the NSA issue, or the question of whether they're using NSA-derived data to target individuals. I mean, I think the question that the Stingray issue raises is, you know, most troubling is the idea that they would have not been aware of this person as a target of law enforcement investigation were it not for the fact that he made a call that went through Stingray, or that he made a call that went through the NSA surveillance. So the question is, are they identifying targets, you know, through this illegal surveillance and then manufacturing a predicate that they bring to the court to say, you know, this is why we investigated them? And I think, you know, that's definitely an area for investigation, you know, in the months to come. And I think it's a really troubling aspect if it is true.
Now, Trevor and Jeremy, as you can tell, I'm very pleased that your documentary has been produced and broadcast, and I'd like as many people as possible to see it. I referenced earlier the HBO documentary about the Nuremberg Four. In the last week, we've seen a report come from Human Rights Watch, which underscores many of the same issues that these paid provocateurs and informants actually set up the crimes that people then, for whatever reasons, tried to implement. And also, a few months ago, I interviewed a retired attorney from Albany, New York, named Steve Downs. And he had just completed a report called Inventing Terrorists, the Lawfare of Preemptive Prosecution. Now, they analyzed 400 domestic terrorism cases, and the data is really pretty clear. 72% involved what they described as preemptive investigations that featured paid informants and provocateurs who often supplied the idea and the means for plots. And another 22% involved minor non-terrorist crimes that were manipulated and amplified by the FBI. So first, to those statistics, Trevor, are those consistent with your own analysis from the book Terror Factory?
Yeah, you know, I know Stephen Downs, and he does excellent work. I haven't personally gone through his data, but, you know, for the broad strokes of what you describe, it sounds very similar. You know, what I looked at with the data analysis that was done in my book was 508 defendants who were prosecuted in the decade after 9/11. And of those 508, there were only five that you could point to that were, you know, truly dangerous threats. Faisal Shahzad, for example, in New York, or Najib Olazazi, also in New York. Of those 500, a fair number of them were cases that you really, you know, would be hard-pressed to describe as being involved in any kind of terrorism plot. This was allegations that people provided money to terrorist organizations. It was immigration violations of people that the government said were terrorism related. So, for example, someone was charged with immigration violation and then deported, and the government said that was, a terrorism related case. And of the in the case of the 10 years worth of data, there of the 500, there were 150 who were involved in terrorism sting operations where the government provided the means and the opportunity. So, of those 508 individuals, I can point to five and say, you know, those were dangerous guys. The rest were a variety of questionable cases. Regarding the terrorism sting operations, I think it's worth noting that, you know, obviously that data is old. It goes, my data from the book, you know, goes up to September 2011. Right now, we're right around 200 defendants who have been caught in terrorism-related sting operations. So this is something that the government has continued, you know, in the years and continues to pursue very aggressively.
And with this, you know, exposure that I just enumerated, your report, the HBO documentary, the Human Rights Watch report, are you seeing any new interest from the oversight committees on Capitol Hill about reining in the FBI and limiting its use of these tactics?
I think we've got some more work to do to sort of push some of this material in front of their desks and talk to them a little bit more about this particular tactic, because it really is something that happens in the shadows and in the darkness and doesn't have a lot of light shed on it. And it's been surprising to me over the course of the past 6 months that so little is known across the general public about these particular tactics that the government uses in counterterrorism. And, you know, I think there's probably a select few lawmakers who are tuned in and do sort of understand the minutia, but overall, you know, the bandwidth, I don't think, is there right now for a lot of these lawmakers to take on this issue in particular. I mean, it's not something that you see as something that they run on. And, you know, with the short election cycles, I doubt it's something that too many politicians are going to get too deep into right now.
Well, and I do understand your political analysis there, Jeremy, but I see this as something that rises well above politics and really is at the heart of the constitutional rights that we enjoy as citizens. And that's where, you know, the political calculus to me exposes a kind of cynicism where our elected leaders are really not recognizing this threat to our rights.
Yeah, the rights issue is one thing, and also the fact that we're spending a ton of money on these counterterrorism operations and what are we getting for as a result, I think is another major thing that lawmakers need to think about and be responsible for. Is it worth the billions of dollars that we've allocated for these counterterrorism sting operations?
Mm-hmm. And gentlemen, as we wrap up here, I want to note that, Trevor, you've done quite a bit of work on the FBI investigations into political corruption here in California, where we have now three suspended state senators accused of various crimes. One was convicted of a voter fraud issue because he didn't live in the district. But the other two involve allegations of bribery. And the most salacious case involves a San Francisco state senator named Leland Yee and his links to a Chinese criminal gang leader named Raymond Shrimp Boy Chow. And today, the San Francisco Chronicle is reporting that the FBI, in its efforts to see just how far this corruption network ran in San Francisco, made $20,000 in political campaign contributions to Mayor Ed Lee. And I'd like to ask you, Trevor, to characterize if you think that the FBI is too aggressive in these corruption stings, because I'm pretty well prepared to believe that Leland Yee and Ron Calderon have some exposure here. Let me just put it that way. But they even tried to bribe Joe Montana, the former star quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers. And it seems to me that they are running amok. And again, there doesn't appear to be anybody who really gives reality checks to some of these schemes that the FBI dreams up.
Sure, Peter. Yeah, and I appreciate you associating that work with me, but that definitely was a team effort. You know, Jeremy Young was involved in that, as Josh Bernstein, another reporter here at the investigative unit. That was a real team effort. And we were really heartened to see, you know, the reaction that we got from the Calderon stories. It's a really tough question. I guess I would say this. What was unique about the Ron Calderon investigation compared to, say, counterterrorism sting operations is that in the Ron Calderon investigation, the FBI created a front company, this film company, that was going to pay him bribes or allegedly paid him bribes in order to steer legislation. And had that been the only time that Ron Calderon had ever been involved in something like that, where he was taking money to allegedly steer legislation, then it would be similar to these counterterrorism stings, and you could make the argument that the FBI was making available, creating the opportunity for a crime to occur that otherwise wouldn't. In the Ron Calderon case, for example, it wasn't just the FBI front company. Ron Calderon was allegedly also providing money to a doctor named Michael Drobot, who was benefiting from legislation that he was helping to steer in California. And so while I agree that there are questions about how aggressive the FBI should be, I would say that there was a greater predicate involved in the Ron Calderon case than there is in many of these counterterrorism sting cases. And with the public corruption investigations, we do tend to see examples of the defendants acting without the FBI provocateur being there. So in Ron Calderon's case, he was allegedly providing bribes to Michael Drobot to steer this legislation, while he was also receiving bribes from the FBI front company. But FBI stings are always kind of a controversial area, and, you know, have the opportunity for, going overboard, going out of bounds, you know, in large measure because these types of cases are career makers, and an ambitious FBI agent is often kind of willing to push the limits, and the question is whether the FBI has the controls in place to keep that from happening. I can't speak a lot about the Yi case only because I don't know as much about it. But as I said, I do want to draw the distinction between these counterterrorism sting operations where the FBI is making the opportunity to commit a crime available that otherwise wouldn't be, with something that happened with Calderon, where this was a guy who was taking bribes, allegedly, even before the FBI provided the sting operation or set up the sting operation.
Yeah, I do understand that. And I've known Leland Yee since he first went to the legislature. That's over 20 years ago. And I've always suspected that, he was not completely above board. At the same time, it appears that the gun-running allegation that has been made, and which is quite dramatic and grabs headlines, appears to be, based on a potential entrapment scene where this paid informant, Shrimp Boy, at least from the news accounts to date, was the one who asked Leland Yee if he could get guns from the Philippines. And so, I worry that we are crossing lines here in terms of creating criminal opportunities to see if somebody will fall into that trap. And as you stated, related to Calderon, there seemed to be enough evidence, freestanding, that you don't have to create new examples or new incidents that could be perceived as entrapment. And this, again, I don't expect you to be able to comment about, what is appropriate for FBI management. But I do think that we might agree that there appears to be a too little management of some of these cases that come up against critical issues of constitutional rights.
I think what I would say is it's clear that the FBI has been emboldened to pursue these very aggressive sting operations because so many of them have stood up in court. And there has been a very broad interpretation of the conspiracy law, as we see in these counterterrorism sting operations, where the crime isn't, in the counterterrorism sting operation, for example, even though the person was never connected to Al-Qaeda and the only connection to Al-Qaeda was the FBI informant, they are able to be convicted of providing material support to Al-Qaeda because under conspiracy law, since he thought the guy was an Al-Qaeda operative, that was enough. And because that has stood up in court so often, I think you're seeing these more elaborate sting operations involving plots that are somewhat fantastical, such as the one with Yi where he was allegedly smuggling guns, because the conspiracy law allows the FBI to prove and the DOJ to prove the law was broken even when it didn't involve a direct actor such as someone who could import guns, but the conspiracy was talking about providing those guns or running guns in some way. Yeah. And I think that's allowed the FBI to really pursue these plots that, seem a little over the top at times.
And Jeremy, would you like to make a comment?
No, I think Trevor covered it pretty well. I mean, I really, that case is, I'm not as familiar with it as I am with the Calderon case. But, in the Calderon case, he clearly was willing to affect legislation in exchange for money if you read through the details of the investigation. And that, I do think, is particularly problematic, and it reflects a lack of, representation for the people who elect you. And I sort of feel like, especially in Ron Calderon's case, there's a lot of individuals in that community who aren't being really very well represented in the California legislature.
That's an understatement. Jeremy Young, senior producer at Al Jazeera America, and Trevor Aronson, who is an investigative reporter and the anchor for this important documentary called FBI Informant. There's a link to it in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Gentlemen, keep up the good work.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
Pretty powerful information about a rogue Federal Bureau of Investigation. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.